I didn't hear anything. I just, you know, mindful of the time. So Linda asked that we should speak a little bit about Yitzchak, which I thought was a good suggestion. So I started talking a little bit last week about how sometimes in life, like, you know, the way that a person is evaluated tells you something about the person, but it also tells you something about the person or the society that evaluates them. It also reflects their values. So Yitzchak was, in broad strokes, an introverted person, you know, and in a like a sort of like the hyper extroverted society that we have now, you know, it's not surprising that, you know, his status has, you know, sort of like come under question. I don't mean that in a bad way. I think it's just very predictable. And then, you know, in addition to the more substantive fact, which is that, you know, there is this very confusing parsha that we have this week, you know, regarding his relationship with Esav, who, you know, is generally, you know, held as an ignominious figure. And, you know, the Torah is very clear that there's some level of disagreement between Yitzchak and Rivka about their children, about, you know, maybe even the question as to, like, the family future. And, you know, is Yitzchak, you know, not just physically blind, but is that how we should understand him? Is somebody who is, like, you know, blinded to the needs of his family, blinded to the realities of his children? And that is, like, a, you know, legitimate question to ask. I very much don't think that was the case, but, you know, there's certainly some explaining that has to be done. So I thought I would divide the presentation into two. First of all, I just want to talk a little bit about Yitzchak as a character, his personality, and then to address more frontally this question about, you know, his family. I think it's important to do it in that order because one, in my judgment, is really a product of the other. Yitzchak, as we know, is associated, you know, with the midah of gevura, of inner strength. Koach is physical strength. For example, in the morning we say, you know, hanotein la ya'ef koach. You're feeling tired, you need physical strength. We also say, ozer Yisrael bigvura. The Jewish people are defined not so much by our physical strength, but by an inner strength, a resilience, a fortitude. You have a woman who's 4'10". You know, who could be the strongest lady you ever met in your life. In the sense of perseverance, in the sense of resolve, you know. She might not be able to pick up a 5-pound barbell, but she's strong in all the ways that count. Yitzchak is associated with gevura, with inner strength. I think that this is manifest in three different ways. First of all, of course, the Akedah. The most basic instinct every person has is, of course, to live. The ultimate act of resolve is a person who's willing to sacrifice themselves for something they believe to be a greater cause, whether it's so that somebody else might live, or as President Lincoln famously said, so that the nation might live, right, in the Gettysburg Address, or in this case, you know, out of service to God and of loyalty to his father's vision. You know, Vayilchu Shnehem Yachdav, that's repeated twice, both before Yitzchak was aware and after he was aware. So that was an act of profound inner strength, of courage. In the end, of course, it was a test, but he didn't know that. Otherwise, it wouldn't have been a test. Number two, you see this, as I alluded to last week, in his willingness to live out his life as a consolidating figure. And people hold that against him. But in some sense, that's the hardest job. You know, if you tell somebody, you know, your historical role is really to take the gains of the previous generation and make sure to hold them. Like Ben Franklin said to that lady in the story, whether it's apocryphal or not, and she comes out of the convention and says, you know, what kind of government is it, Dr. Franklin? And he says, a republic, ma'am, if you can keep it. You have to keep it. You have to guard it. It was an impressive thing that the founders created a republic. But Dr. Franklin was saying it's only as good as, you know, the next generation that comes along to guard the republic, to value the Constitution, right? Look at the French Revolution as something relatively contemporaneous, 13 years after the American Revolution. Look how that ended up. So it's not enough to have the revolution of Avram. You have to have succession. You have to have somebody who's willing to say, this is my life's work. I am not going to be, you know, the original figure that my father... So that also requires a lot of inner strength. That's also a form of sublimation, of sacrifice, that's consistent with the Akedah in that regard. Now, again, you know, people don't tend to value that. People, especially today, again, you know, who are the icons of this society? If you really think about it, the great icons of this society are people who create things, the startup people. It doesn't matter what they do. They could be the most unethical people in the world, and it could crash and burn. But there's almost a religious-like fervor that surrounds, you know, these startups, these technology companies. They, even when they launch their new products, they have these rituals. They get up there. They have these special clothes. You know, it's a religious ritual. It's a 21st century religious ritual, but they're worshipped, right? Somebody who responsibly stewards an existing company, you know, pays the bills on time, grows things incrementally, you know, there's not a lot of hype about them. And yet, you know, that's absolutely vital. So Yitzchak, right, that's also part of his gevura. The third element is prayer. Prayer is always a reflection of a person's inner life. If you really want to know somebody's inner world, there may be some that are as good, but probably no better reflection of a person's inner world than the world of prayer. And Yitzchak occupies, in a very profound way, the world of prayer. A word on that. So we know, the Gemara in Brachos talks about how the different avos founded different tfilos. So Avram tikein shachris, Yitzchak tikein tfilas mincha, Yaakov tikein tfilas arvis. But it's not correct to say, or not fully correct to say, that their contribution was, you know, establishing davening at different times. The real contribution was to establish the different modalities of prayer. So the pasuk says about Avram, "Vayashkem Avraham baboker ela makom asher amad sham, ein amida ela tefila." That Avram's idea was that a person could stand in the presence of God. There could be some rendezvous between the divine and the human. That was remarkable. The idea that God could be approached in that way and by a human being. Yitzchak was different. Vayetze Yitzchak lasuach basadel. If no sarev, we read it this past Shabbos, ein sicha latvila, to have this ongoing inner conversation with God. Yitzchak's not in dialogue with very many people, but he is constantly in dialogue with God. He introduced the idea of an inner conversation with God. He has a very rich inner world. It's harder to measure about a person, but there's still waters that run very deep. So that's kind of Yitzchak. Yitzchak went even further, though, because Yitzchak also introduced the notion of prayer in a time of crisis. Now, typically we think about this in terms of Yaakov. When Yaakov was running away from Esav, Esav was going to kill him. It was nighttime. Ein pigia l'lashon tefila. But really, you know, we see at the beginning of the parsha this very striking image of Vayetar Yitzchak l'Hashem enochach ishto ki akarahi. They're having a crisis. Everybody knows that that's a very painful crisis to have. People are unable to start a family. And this terrible suffering that comes with that, anguish. And Yitzchak prays, Vayetar Yitzchak l'Hashem l'nochach ishto. Of course, there's the Midrash that says they were in opposite corners, right? The simple meaning of the pasuk is that, you know, opposite his wife, on behalf of his wife, Yitzchak is deeply involved in prayer. I think this is all consistent. He's trying to portray some of his character strength. So there's somebody who was, again, very substantive and not very flashy. Somebody whose conversation was with God as opposed to with people. And somebody who had a very profound gravitas. To the point where, right, when Rivka saw Yitzchak, you know, in prayer at the end of last week's parsha, when she's coming back from Haran, she, you know, whether you think she literally fell off the camel or she's overwhelmed by his presence. Not just Vatipol me'al ha'gamal, but Vatikach ha'tsa'if ha'titkas. She immediately senses that there's something, the word would be numinous, deeply spiritual about him. And she feels the need to be modest in that context. That's a remarkable thing. Very few people have that kind of presence. We all have experienced it. You know, somebody walks into the room and their gravitas is such that it just, you know, the entire room responds to it. But that was something that you don't even see necessarily with Avram or with Yaakov. Nobody has that reaction to them. But Yitzchak's inner world is so profound. He's a figure of such deep reservoirs of faith in God, you know, as evidenced by the Akedah, as evidenced by the way that he sublimated his own life to consolidate his father's mission, and certainly by his contributions to the world of Tefillah, that I think perhaps then it's unsurprising, though no less impressive, that Rivka is moved in this way by him. Okay, that's my sense of who Yitzchak is as a character. What about the family? So I think this is the nexus point between the two halves of the discussion. Yitzchak understood himself very much to be his father's son.
To be the what?
His father's son. He deeply admired his father's contribution. The pasuk, the beginning of this week's parsha, Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avraham. These are literally the generations, or sometimes it's, you know, rendered as the, you know, sort of the legacy of Yitzchak. What was the first thing said about Yitzchak? Avraham holidus Yitzchak. The first thing that you have to know about him is who his father was. This is not true of everybody, but we all know people. If you want to have any hope of understanding them, you have to have known their mother or their father. And that's, I think, an extremely important point. Avram, to know anything about him, you have to know that he transcended the world of his father. Yaakov had a very different life experience than his father. But the foundation of who Yitzchak is he sees himself as his father's son. Why is that important? Well, it's important in the family sense for the following reason. You know, we know that Avram, whose tent was open on four sides, suffered greatly at the notion of having to choose between Yitzchak and Ishmael. Ultimately, he's compelled to do so. Though perhaps only temporarily, there's very substantial body of evidence that after the passing of Sarah, that Yishmael re-enters the scene, not just because he comes back into the text, which he does, right? The end of Chayei Sarah is the lineage of Yishmael, the fact that he died. The Torah makes it very clear that he died a righteous person. Terminology which is reserved for the righteous is used to describe his death. Vayigva vayamos vayasef elamav. But perhaps even more importantly, Yitzchak volitionally chooses to continue to reside with Yishmael. Vayeshev Yitzchak im be'er l'chai roi. Be'er l'chai roi. That goes back to Parshas Lech Lecha. That's where Hagar, when she first ran away, when she was pregnant, informed of Yishmael's birth, that was the place that was always associated with Hagar and Yishmael. You remember the Midrash, which says, oh, Yitzchak was going there to bring Hagar back into the family. Yitzchak saw his responsibility is to reunite the family. It couldn't happen during Sarah's lifetime. Perhaps the tension between Sarah and Hagar was too great. Perhaps Yitzchak was still in a formative age and the influence of Yishmael would have been problematic. But the bottom line is that Yishmael makes his father's deepest wish a reality by bringing the family back together, by bringing Hagar back into the fold, and by bringing Yishmael back into the fold. That's critical to understand what Yitzchak's vision was for his own family. It's not an insignificant fact that Yitzchak is the only one of the Avos to have only one wife. Yitzchak understood very well that by introducing, and again, remember, it wasn't Avraham's idea, nor was it Yaakov's idea, but it happened to both of them. But Yitzchak wouldn't let it happen. And the reason he wouldn't let it happen is he understood very well the rivalries, the friction that inherently creates. And Yitzchak, from the beginning, planned on having a united family. He has these twins after 20 years of frustration. It's a miraculous thing. And his plan, clearly, is to create a role for both of them. And, you know, it seems like it's kind of going according to plan because they've differentiated on their own. So again, if you are A, your father's son, and B, your father deeply wished to keep the family united and suffered terribly at having to choose between his sons. So then C, the thing to do is to carve out a role for both of them. And that's going to be relatively straightforward because Yaakov is going to bear the spiritual legacy of Avram. But the world is a complicated place. And as we say, Ein Kemach, Ein Torah, if there's nobody to provide in the physical sense, you know, it's just not going to happen. You know, and that's what our community is built on, is the model of synthesis, that we need to have both. Still true today. It will always be true. And Esav was going to be, and he was very well suited to be the provider. Right, remember that when Yitzchak is going to give Esav, I don't like to say the bracha, I think that's where the misunderstanding comes in, but a bracha, what does he tell him to do? Tells him to go and hunt and bring him food, right? This is not like a quid pro quo, right? This is not, you bring me the food and I give you the bracha, right? But this is, no, the reason that you are receiving this bracha is because of your capacity to do this. And if you look at the text of that bracha, a lot of it focuses on material leadership. Now, of course, Yaakov deceptively takes that bracha, and we'll discuss that in weeks ahead. Rivka's idea is that, like Sarah, Esav cannot really be part of the family's destiny, cannot be part of the family's future. She understands that Yaakov has a lot to learn as an Ishtam Yoshev Ohalim. So if Yaakov is going to not only be the spiritual leader, but is also going to be responsible for the physical welfare of the family in a very complicated world where not everybody is Nishtam Yoshev Olim, far from it. So then what do? You send Yaakov to Lavan's house to learn how to deal with the real world, so to speak. And he does, and she does. So Yitzhak's plan was, it would appear, a very straightforward one. Keep the family together. Esav seems very well suited to provide material protection, physical protection, and Yaakov will ensure that the spiritual legacy of the family remains intact, and that's good. And so he's, you know, prepared to give Esav his bracha. And at the end of the parsha, he gives Yaakov a completely different bracha. Not the one that, you know, he stole from Esav, but he says, V'ten lachas berkas Avraham, the blessing of Avram, the legacy of Avram, tzedek and mishpat, etc. So Yitzhak wasn't wrong. He was, you know, in a way he was sort of ahead of his time, right? Yaakov was the only one who really merited this in the full sense of being able to basically do exactly that, right? Levi gets, you know, a very different treatment than Yehuda, than does Yosef, right? Yaakov is able to keep all the 12 in the picture. He creates the idea that this one is going to be involved in commerce, and this one is going to have a, you know, a leadership role in the political sense, right, for Yehuda, and this one is going to be involved in teaching of Torah, etc., right? So the idea wasn't wrong. The problem wasn't so much that Esav was not Yaakov. The problem was that Esav was not Yishmael. The problem was that Esav apparently was not even able to be in that framework, and he was not redeemable in that sense. So Yitzhak has to be, I think, understood in that context as his father's son, who seeks very much to hold the family together, who has developed, I think, a very elegant notion of a division of responsibility in terms of leadership. Spirituality will be, you know, Yaakov's domain, and the physical realm will be Esav, and somehow they'll, you know, merge that together. And that, of course, was not the way that it would work out. And Yitzchak has this terrible moment of recognition. Vayecharad Yitzchak charada gedola ad ma'od. When Yitzchak comes to realize that that's not God's intention, he has this, right? It's a frightful moment for him. And Esav keeps on begging him, can't you just give me a bracha? And Yitzchak keeps on saying, you know, you don't understand. There's no bracha left for you, because he's not blinded to who Esav is. Esav is not capable of providing spiritual leadership. What he was hoping was that Esav would be the one to provide the physical leadership. But then Yaakov demonstrates, albeit in a deceptive way, that he too is capable of providing physically, right? And again, you know, he had to be pushed into it by his mother, and that's a very important and complicated story. But I think this is who Yitzchak is as a father. Every parent wants each one of their children to have a role. It's not a parent's blindness. A parent doesn't think their children are necessarily the same. A parent believes that each child can have some role, has something to contribute to the family structure. There's no parent that says, you know, this child is exactly the same as that one. You have to be foolish for that. Yitzchak was no fool. You know, Yitzchak was not like, you know, thinking that Esav was going to be, you know, some great scholar. But he saw that he had certain abilities. He had certain contributions that he would have been able to make. Yitzchak was hoping. You're no different than any of us in that regard. And Rivka, and a lot of this is the fact that she has a different understanding of the nevuah that she's given, right? V'rav yavod sa'ir, that Yaakov is meant to be the one who ultimately has spiritual leadership, but also the physical leadership as well. But I think it's very important to see Yitzchak in that way. So again, it wasn't so much that, you know, he thought, okay, Esav is going to be the leader of the family in the next generation. I think that's basically a misreading of the parsha. And I think that ultimately, you know, Yitzchak's deepest wish becomes Yaakov's reality. Remember, Yaakov gives a bracha to each of his children, and as the pasuk says, Ish asher kivir chaso beirachosam, each one in accordance with who they were. He didn't turn Yisachar into Zvulun, he didn't turn Zvulun into Yisachar, he didn't turn Yehuda into Yosef, he certainly didn't turn Yosef into Yehuda, but everybody had a role to play. That's the whole idea of Shivtei Kav, there being 12 different tribes, or there being different ways of thinking about serving Hashem, and different ways of going about it. Is there room for criticism? I think there is. You know, I alluded to this last week. Rav Hirsch was of the view that part of the reason that Esav didn't become who Yitzchak thought he could be was that there was insufficient attention at an early age to differentiation. The pasuk says that I quoted before, "Vayigdalu ha-ne'arim, vayhi Esav ish yodei tzayid ish sadeh, v'yakov ish tam yoshev olim." So Rav Hirsch thinks that had Yitzchak and Rivka allowed Esav to develop from an earlier age, you know, focus mostly on the sadeh, what we would call the vocational, you know, aspects, that would have been much better in the end for Esav's own development, and he wouldn't have felt a sense of frustration that ultimately led him to rebel. And again, you know, Esav rebelling is not a matter of midrash; that's in the text itself. Right? What does he do? He repudiates the most basic aspect of the spiritual pact of the family, which is not to marry the Benos Canaan. That was like, you know, the defining part of his father's life. And he repudiates that. He marries not just one, but two of the Benos Ches, of the Benos Canaan. And that's a remarkable thing because it's actually a double repudiation of his father. A, marrying a woman from Canaan, and B, marrying two at the same time. Yitzchak's entire essence was his devotion to Rivka and devotion to the unity of a family. But Esav isn't entirely obtuse, right? He knows that his parents are deeply aggrieved by this. And then what does he do? Because he wants to make his father especially happy. Who does he go and marry? The daughter of Yishmael, which again proves the point that Yitzchak and Yishmael had to have had a very close relationship. Otherwise, the whole thing makes no sense. It just makes his father more angry. So again, the it doesn't work out. And, you know, if Rav Hirsch is correct, then maybe Yitzchak is partly to blame for that, because maybe he was sort of late to recognize some of who Esav actually was, instead of maybe he was hoping, you know, who Esav might be, and that's something that we all deal with, to love the child for who they are, not, you know, for whatever we imagine that they might be. But more importantly, I think it's important to see Yitzchak's aspirations. And Yitzchak's aspirations was really what his father's were, effectively, is to be at the head of a unified family where everybody would be able to find their place. I don't think that's a matter of being blind in the figurative sense. I think that's a natural and very healthy wish. That Esav couldn't be that person is also part of the tragedy of life. Sometimes there's somebody who can't even be that, and that's tragic for Yitzchak, and it's tragic for Esav as well. And ultimately, Yaakov will then have to assume the dual mantle of leadership, the spiritual mantle, which was always his from a young age, right? You know, Esav wasn't fighting Yaakov to be an Ishtam Yosheva Aliyim. He wasn't saying, you know, no, give me the Gemara. You know, that wasn't the issue. But Yaakov is going to have to learn. And the rest of the drama of Sefer Bereishis is really all about that. And it's about how Yaakov, very much the hard way, has to learn how to contend with the world. And nobody saw it before his mother did. The same mother that loved him so dearly, Virivko Heves as Yaakov, some people think that she thought, oh, Yaakov was perfect. She saw earlier than anybody else did that he would need, you know, to go to the University of Life, i.e. the House of Lavan, to learn what it really means to be spiritual in this world and how to deal with people, you know, who are just deceptive, cynical, selfish, people who don't have spiritual motives, right? The test of spirituality basically is, how does a person who thinks in value-based categories, how does a person who thinks in terms of ethics, how does a person who thinks in terms of doing the right thing by God and by man deal with people who don't even interact in those categories? People who are deeply selfish or deeply narcissistic or deeply materialistic or deeply unethical. I mean, the world is just filled with these people. And the test of spirituality is like, well, how do I exist in that world? You know, so do I just sort of turn off the spiritual button when I'm dealing with people like that? Do I pretend like they're like operating with the same value-based categories that I do and allow myself to be robbed blind? Like, how do you deal with that? It becomes a very complex question for all of us. So that's the question of the rest of Sefer Bereishis. How is Yaakov in Ishtam Yosheva Olim going to deal with now the fact that he has to provide for the family physically? Yitzchak's paradigm would have subverted that question. Yaakov wouldn't have had to deal with it. Esav would have showed up every month and said, here's your allotment. And he would take care of the world. And that's not a bad idea. You know, ultimately, that's what happens between Yisachar and Zvulun, right? Zvulun goes out, you know, they're involved in finance, the hedge fund, right? And, you know, Yisachar's learning and, you know, say, well, you know, how much do you need? That's fine. That's okay, as long as it's worked out amicably between the two of them. So, you know, in fact, Yitzchak anticipated this model. Yeah. I include that. Yitzchak anticipated this. The tragedy of his life is that it doesn't come to pass in his lifetime. But again, I don't think it's a matter of blindness. I think, you know, it's far more complicated than that. So again, this is my little, I don't want to say defense, because I don't think he needs my defense, but my understanding of who Yitzchak is as a person, A, and then as a corollary to that, B, how that, you know, really reflected itself in what otherwise appears to be, you know, a very troubling series of episodes with his family. But I think, again, it really has to do with his relationship with his own father and his deep, deep desire to keep the entire family together, a desire that in his lifetime would go unrealized but would become the reality of Yaakov. And Yaakov's ultimately greatest triumph is keeping the Shivtei Kava, Yuvenei Yaakov Shnei Masar, just one generation after Yitzchak would have wished it for himself.